Chapter 27. From Tiberius Gracchus to the God Emperor in Rome. First, the science of thwarting the common man. Second, finance in the Roman state. Third, the last years of republican politics. Fourth, the era of the adventurer generals. Fifth, the end of the republic. Sixth, the coming of the princeps. Seventh, why the Roman Republic failed. First, we've already twice likened the self-governing community of Rome to a Neanderthal variety of the modern democratic civilized state, and we'll recur again to this comparison. In form, the two things, the first great primitive essay and its later relations, are extraordinarily similar. In spirit, they differ very profoundly. Roman political and social life, and particularly Roman political and social life in the century between the fall of Carthage and the rise of Caesar and Caesarism, has a very marked general resemblance to the political and social life in such countries as the United States of America or the British Empire today. The resemblance is intensified by the common use, with a certain inaccuracy in every case, of such terms as Senate, democracy, proletariat, and the like. But everything in the Roman state was earlier, cruder, and clumsier. The injustices were more glaring, the conflicts harsher. There was comparatively little knowledge and few general ideas. Aristotle's scientific works were only beginning to be read in Rome in the first century BC. Ferrero, it's true, makes Caesar familiar with the politics of Aristotle and ascribes to him the dream of making a Periclean Rome, but in doing so, Ferrero seems to be indulging in one of those lapses into picturesque romancing, which are at once the joy and the snare of all historical writers. Attention has already been drawn to the profound difference between Roman and modern conditions due to the absence of a press, of any popular education, or of the representative idea in the popular assembly. Our world today is still far from solving the problem of representation and from producing a public assembly which will really summarize, crystallize, and express the thought and will of the community. Our elections are still largely an ingenious mockery of the common voter who finds himself helpless in the face of party organizations which reduce his free choice of a representative to the less unpalatable of two political hacks. But even so, his vote, in comparison with the vote of an ordinary honest Roman citizen, is an effective instrument. Too many of our histories dealing with this period of Roman history write of the popular party and of the votes of the people and so forth as though such things were as much working realities as they are today. But the senators and politicians of Rome saw to it that such things never did exist as clean and wholesome realities. These modern phrases are very misleading, unless they're carefully qualified. We've already described the gatherings of the popular comitia, but that clumsy assembly in sheep pens doesn't convey the full extent to which the gerrymandering of popular representation could be carried in Rome. Whenever there was a new enfranchisement of citizens in Italy, there would be the most elaborate trickery and counter-trickery to enroll the new voters into as few or as many of the 30 old tribes as possible, or to put them into as few as possible new tribes. Since the vote was taken by tribes, it's obvious that however great the number of new additions made, if they were all got together into one tribe, their opinion would only count for one tribal vote, and similarly, if they were crowded into just a few tribes, old or new. On the other hand, if they were put into too many tribes, their effect on any particular tribe might be inconsiderable. Here was the sort of work to fascinate every smart knave in politics. The Comitia Tributa could be worked at times so as to vote right counter to the general feeling of the people. And, as we've already noted, the great mass of voters in Italy were also disenfranchised by distance. About the middle period of the Carthaginian Wars, there were upwards of 300,000 Roman citizens. About 100 BC, there were more than 900,000, but in effect, the voting of the popular assembly was confined to a few score thousand resident in and near Rome, and mostly men of a base type. And the Roman voters were organized to an extent that makes the Tammany machine of New York seem artless and honest. They belonged to clubs, collegia sodalitia, having usually some elegant religious pretensions. And the rising politician, working his way to office, went first to the usurers and then, with the borrowed money, to these clubs. If the outside voters were moved enough by any question to swarm into the city, it was always possible to put off the voting by declaring the omens unfavorable. If they came in unarmed, they could be intimidated. If they brought in arms, then the cry was raised that there was a plot to overthrow the Republic, and a massacre would be organized. There can be no doubt that all Italy, all the empire, was festering with discomfort, anxiety, and discontent in the century after the destruction of Carthage. A few men were growing very rich, and the majority of people found themselves entangled in an inexplicable net of uncertain prices, jumpy markets, and debts. But yet there was no way at all of stating and clearing up the general dissatisfaction. There's no record of a single attempt to make the popular assembly a straightforward and workable public organ. Beneath the superficial appearances of public affairs struggled a mute giant of public opinion and public will, who sometimes made some great political effort to rush to vote or such like, and sometimes broke into actual violence. So long as there was no actual violence, the Senate and the financiers kept on in their own disastrous way. Only when they were badly frightened would governing cliques or parties desist from such nefarious policy and heed the common good. The real method of popular expression in Italy in those days was not the Comitia Tributa, but the strike and insurrection, the righteous and necessary methods of all cheated or suppressed peoples. We've seen in our own days in Great Britain a decline in the prestige of parliamentary government, and a drift towards unconstitutional methods on the part of the masses through exactly the same cause, through the incurable disposition of politicians to gerrymander the electoral machine until the community is driven to explosion. For insurrectionary purposes, a discontented population needs a leader, and the political history of the concluding century of Roman republicanism is a history of insurrectionary leaders and counter-revolutionary leaders. Most of the former are manifestly unscrupulous adventurers who try to utilize the public necessity and unhappiness for their own advancement. Many of the historians of this period betray a disposition to take sides and are either aristocratic in tone or fiercely democratic. But indeed, neither side in these complex and intricate disputes has a record of high aims or clean hands. The Senate and the rich equestrians were vulgar and greedy spirits, hostile and contemptuous towards the poor mob, and the populace was ignorant, unstable, and at least equally greedy. The Scipios, in all this record, shine by comparison a group of gentlemen. To the motives of one or the other figures of the time, to Tiberius Gracchus, for example, we may perhaps extend the benefit of the doubt, but for the rest, they do but demonstrate how clever and cunning men may be, how subtle in contention, how brilliant in pretense, and how utterly wanting in wisdom or grace of spirit. A shambling, hairy, brutish, but probably very cunning creature with a big brain behind. So someone, I think it was Sir Harry Johnston, has described Homo Neanderthalensis. To this day, we must still use similar terms to describe the soul of the politician. The statesman has still to oust the politician from his lairs and weapon heaps. History has still to become a record of human dignity. Second, another respect in which the Roman system was a crude anticipation of our own, and different from any preceding political system we've considered, was that it was a cash and credit-using system. Money had been in the world, as yet, for only a few centuries, but its use had been growing. It was providing a fluid medium for trade and enterprise, and changing economic conditions profoundly. In Republican Rome, the financier and the money interest began to play a part recognizably similar to their roles today. We've already noted in our account of Herodotus that a first effect of money was to give freedom of movement and leisure to a number of people who could not otherwise have enjoyed these privileges. And that's the peculiar value of money to mankind. Instead of a worker or helper being paid in kind, and in such a way that he's tied as much in his enjoyment as in his labor, money leaves him free to do as he pleases amidst a wide choice of purchasable aids, eases, and indulgences. He may eat his money, or drink it, or give it to a temple, or spend it in learning something, or save it against some unforeseen occasion. That's the good of money, the freedom of its universal convertibility. But the freedom money gives the poor man is nothing to the freedom money has given the rich man. With money, rich men ceased to be tied to lands, houses, stores, flocks, and herds. They could change the nature and locality of their possessions with an unheard-of freedom.